Right, let's get cracking, I think. Good morning. Welcome to our resumed Employment Law 101 series. We had a little break over Easter, but back into the swing of it today. My name is Peter. I'm a partner with MPM Legal. We're a specialist employment and business immigration practice based in the south of England. We work with companies that are all over the world that have a common interest, which is employing people here in the UK, and that's where we help them. Delighted as ever to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning on this beautiful sunny day.
Beautiful sunshine here today, and I hope it's nice where you are. Just a couple of housekeeping points. This session is being recorded, so you will be able to dip back into it on our website, npmlegal.co.uk. Later, that's where all the back recordings from these webinars are kept. You can also access the audio of these on Spotify. Just search for Employment Law 101. We've got, I don't know, 65 episodes on there, so there's something for everybody. We're also on Amazon Music and Apple Podcasts, I think, now. So, yeah, whatever your platform is, go check it out. If you've got any questions, and I anticipate there might be a few questions today, although we may not be able to answer them, but ask away because I am interested to know what your thought processes are. Please use the Q&A function down at the bottom. If you want to chat amongst you, the chat should be open. So you should be able to chat with other participants. Just use the chat function for that. If you've got any general sort of comments or observations, just put them in the chat. But questions, please use the Q&A. Right, without further ado, what are we talking about today? Well, it is quite a difficult area of law, for a variety of reasons, I think it's fair to say. But as you will know, the Supreme Court on the 16th of April gave their judgment dealing with a particular knotty issue, which was, is a person with a full gender recognition certificate, which recognises that their gender is female, a woman for the purposes of the Equality Act 2010? And of course, all of you that are working in employment law or in HR teams or in-house legal teams that have responsibility for employment law, you will know that the Equality Act is the primary bit of legislation dealing with rights in the workplace. It consolidated things like the Race Relations Act, Disability Discrimination Act. So it's all to do with rights in the workplace concerning discrimination. So, to decide this particular issue, it was necessary for the court to look into what man, woman, and sex means within the Equality Act 2010 specifically. So, in that bit of legislation, what do those terms mean? Now, the wider context for this judgment, how it got to the Supreme Court, is this. The Scottish Parliament brought in a new law relating to essentially the ability to positively discriminate in favour of women when it came to the makeup of company boards. And I'd just say that this law didn't mean that women would get priority full stop, but in cases where all things were equal in terms of board appointments, so things like, experience, skill set, all those sorts of factors you'd normally be looking at. If you were in essentially a tiebreak situation, a company could elect to appoint a woman over a man. And I guess that's to do with representation on boards, right? There was a reason why this issue arose, right, Adrienne?
Yeah, exactly. And it was basically because the question and the challenge came up because trans women with a gender recognition certificate could be included in the definition of a woman and could therefore, well, the concern was that they could benefit under this law for this priority approach. And it was that the Four Women Scotland brought the matter to court to challenge that particular aspect. And I think it's, you've said it a couple of times already. I think it's really important to remember that this judgment was about clarifying the definitions in the Equality Act alone, just this act. And it was a question of whether or not the Scottish law had overridden the provisions of the Equality Act. So that's the context in which the Supreme Court was looking at it. And I would say that before we go on to talk about the judgment, we don't have the answers to many of the burning issues, and I'm sure loads of you will have read a lot of commentary around it and what's going on in the press. And it's also likely that where we are now is probably not the end of this particular issue. But let's see what the let's have a little chat about what the Supreme Court actually said. And it's an 88-page judgment. And one of the things I noted to Peter when I read it was, in actual fact, it's a lengthy judgment, but it's a very interesting and judgment that is, I thought, was really well put together and easy to read. But in essence, in the Equality Act, sex means biological sex, so that a woman is a biological woman or girl where they were born female, and a man is a biological man where they were born male. And the decision is that for the purposes of the Equality Act, if somebody identifies as trans, they do not change sex. So a trans man a trans woman is a biological man, and a trans man is a biological woman. And that's what the Supreme Court found in their judgment. It's an incredibly emotive issue, and it's quite difficult to talk about, actually. But the Supreme Court were at pains to say that the law protecting trans people hasn't changed. They're still to be protected from discrimination because of their protected characteristic of gender reassignment. And, it's been widely reported in the press, with various parties wanting to challenge it and other parties demonstrating that they're delighted with the judgment. But And a lot of people are saying that this provides clarity, but I'm not so sure that it necessarily does, because the practical applications of this are actually really muddled and unclear, and very often they're going to create more questions than they solve. And we'll talk about some of them today. But as I said, we don't necessarily have all the answers, but we'll try and discuss it as best we possibly can. So that's the Supreme Court judgment in a nutshell. If you want to go away and read the 88-page judgment, then please do. You can find it online. But then we have the Equalities and Human Rights Commission, and they've given their sort of interim update. So what have they said, Peter? Talk us a bit through that.
Yeah. So for those of you that joined us for the episode we did where we were looking at prevention of workplace sexual harassment, so we did quite a deep dive into that. You'll know that we lean quite heavily into the Equalities and Human Rights Commission and how they function, that they're there as a statutory body. So for those of you that are not so familiar with that organisation, the Commission is a statutory body that enforces the Equality Act 2010. So they will take enforcement action from time to time against organisations. I think McDonald's have been working with the Equality and Human Rights Commission in respect of harassment within their within some of their outlets, and other organisations as well. So they take an intervening role. Now, as a result of this judgment, they've obviously had their work cut out, because it's the way that common law works in this country. You get a judgment, and that can change the law instantly, or provide clarification as it's been billed. So they produced an interim update on the ruling last week. So if you go on the EHRC website, you'll be able to see in technicolor glory what that update says. They've said, well, we're working behind the scenes at pace to provide updated guidance, and we expect that a code of practice is going to be provided for ministerial approval by the end of June, once they've engaged in a consultation process with various stakeholders. Now, that consultation process is going to happen in May, we think.
It's a couple of weeks.
A two-week process. So look out for that, because as organisations or as industry bodies, you might have an opportunity to feed into that consultation process. However, what they've said is, we believe the Supreme Court has made the legal position clear, so we're not inviting feedback or views on those legal aspects during the consultation. So you're not going to have the opportunity to feedback, or if you do, it's probably going to be ignored if you hold an opposing view to what constitutes a man and a woman for the purposes of the Equality Act. It's going to be more about these knotty practical problems in terms of implementation rather than the underpinning legal position. So just bear that in mind. But in terms of this interim guidance, what does it say? And you've been delving into it.
Yeah, delving into it. I mean, it's not long. It's not long at all. It is exactly that. It's an interim update, and the devil will absolutely be in the detail of those of the practical issues. But it summarizes the key points of the Supreme Court judgment. But then it goes on to say, and this is where it's relevant for employers, point one, front and center, for workplaces, it is compulsory to provide sufficient single-sex toilets, as well as sufficient single-sex changing and washing facilities where those are needed. That's front and center, that's the main point that I took from that guidance. It then goes on to say it is not compulsory for services that open to the public to provide single-sex facilities such as toilets, but there can, however, be single-sex if it is a proportionate means of achieving a legitimate aim. Now, that phrase comes up an awful lot in discrimination law, and from previous podcasts that we've done, you'll know that that, first of all, requires a very clear business aim, and for the proposed actions got to be proportionate in order to justify it. So it's the objective justification point there. So in workplaces and services that are open to the public, trans women should not be permitted to use women's facilities and trans men should not be permitted to use men's facilities. And however, I mean, look, this is going to be problematic for many places. And one of the key issues that's been raised as a problem is that trans people should not find themselves in a position where there are no facilities for them to use. And they're, you know, they're, this is what the guidance is at pains to point out. It says where possible, mixed sex facilities. Sorry, I need to get my teeth in. In addition to sufficient single sex facilities, should be provided. Lockable facilities, and that doesn't mean sort of like, you know, I'm going into the toilets and finding the cubicles within a toilet facility. Lockable facilities intended to be used by one person at a time can be used by either men or women, and that would count as mixed sex. So an awful lot of talk about toilets and facilities, but they do go on to cover other areas which are going to come out as part of the full guidance following consultation, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, there's a reference in there to competitive sports and schools and also association membership organisations as well. They don't really go into any detail much around those. Suffice to say that they'll be addressing the position in due course. But I think, you know, just looking at the media over the last week, there have been reports of certain sporting organisations that are already taking a view in terms of what approach they're going to take. And I think yesterday or the day before, I believe it was Barclays came out in terms of saying what its approach is regarding the use of women and men's toileting facilities on their premises, which, I mean, as you'd expect, I think it replicates what the guidance says. We've got an awful lot of you on the call today. We've got about 100 people on the call. So I am just kind of very curious to know, and by all means, just put this in the chat function, but whether any of you have started looking at policies, whether you've had questions from employees, any concerns raised, just really what you're sort of seeing and what you're finding. I'm really interested to see what you're experiencing kind of on the front line, as it were. In the meantime, Adrienne, what about this kind of real world impact for employers? So obviously many people on the call today working in HR teams, working in organizations. What is the practical impact of some of this?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think it's really difficult to address it, because although it's sort of like a groundbreaking ruling, as we said, there's so much detail that's missing, and the Equalities Commission is going to produce its code of practice. You know, there's a huge amount of commentary. I looked on the CIPD website, and that talks sort of generically about reviewing your policies to make sure that they comply with this ruling. But I mean, I think just looking at the questions that are popping up as we're speaking, the main areas of concern seem so far to be, by far and away, this is going to be about the provision of toilets and changing facilities. And that's what we're seeing in the press as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there are sort of tangential points around this, though, aren't there? Maybe we'll come and talk about those in a moment.
Yeah.
There's a lot of press on the toileting and changing facilities. That's kind of the sort of thrust. And I guess that figures because it ties in with the interim guidance, right? That's what it's leading with. But it's important to note that the position for employers is different for service providers that are open to the public. So in workplaces, the guidance says there must be single sex facilities and that trans people are limited to what they can use. And, you know, in turn, that does flag a lot of issues and open questions, really, like what if there are no mixed sex facilities? What do trans people then use? Well, I've definitely read a comment from at least one person, which was that disability facilities are usually not single sex, but it doesn't mean that it would be appropriate to tell trans people to use those, for example. You know, it could be demeaning for them. It also potentially limits access to facilities to disabled employees, who in turn may also raise complaints as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think this is a really important point to remember, because there's an awful lot of social media out there about facilities for disabled people already being limited. So, you know, you could say, well, that's accessible to all, only to find you're then on the receiving end of a complaint from a disabled employee whose access is then limited. And I think it, you know, it's a very difficult issue. I think, well, some of the comments are coming up, which is talking about, you know, sort of engaging with, you might have landlords in your buildings, for example, about how to do it. In fact, we were talking about our building at work and whether or not, you know, there is sufficient scope. Are there generally enough bathrooms, full stop? And it is potentially problematic unless you move completely to mixed sex. But somebody's asked the question in terms of what's a single, you know, what counts as single sex? And I think the guidance that we've got so far is that it's got to be a lockable facility. As I said before, it can't be just a cubicle. So imagine you walk into the bathroom, you've got a line of sinks on one side, and then you've got three or four cubicles, or stalls, as they're sometimes called, which just has a toilet in it. That, as far as I've read, and my view is that wouldn't be enough to constitute a mixed sex bathroom to meet the definition. The idea is that there is a separate room, essentially, which has a toilet, has a sink in it, and that would be lockable. So that particular room then is designed to be used for one person. And I think that's what they're talking about in terms of facilities. But,
Yeah, it's the lockable cubicles within a room doesn't count, does it? 'Cause
no,
it's a
no.
health and safety executive matter. I mean, if you're curious enough, you can look on the health and safety executive website, and it's got information on there about what constitutes, you know, how you meet your obligations regarding toileting facilities.
Yeah, exactly. And that also deals with what counts as sufficient as well, which is another word that's been chucked in there as well. But so just kind of moving on from that particular bit, one of the other valid points, and I think this is something really important to remember, is that there's an issue here potentially that if employers are in a position where they have to say women can use single-sex facilities for women, men can use them for men, you're in a position where potentially you are outing a trans person where their transition may not be widely known. Now, you know, wow, I mean, where do we start in terms of the potential issues that comes out there? You know, we've got things like data protection for a start. So that person may have confided in you as HR. May not have confided in anybody, but you know, if they haven't and they are living life, say a trans woman is living life as a woman, which is absolutely their, you know, the aim of what they want to do, how are you as the employer meant to deal with that? It's all these types of sort of round the fringe edges, which are actually going to be pretty mainstream in my view, and you know, that's a really difficult issue, and one where employers are going to have to act very sensitively.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking before about, I mean, you and I, before this session, about this outing point, and how it's not really conceivable that the purpose, you know, the intent of this judgment and the intent of any code of practice or guidance from the Equality of Human Rights Commission is going to be to essentially out employees,
Yeah.
because, you know, you've got a situation where there's a trans man, so a now a biological female, so somebody born female who has transitioned to male, who has joined an organization. They've only ever used the male toileting facilities.
Yeah.
Well, under this guidance, their requirement is not to use the male facilities, because for the purposes of the Equality Act, they're not a biological male, right?
Yeah. So
So,
they're changing their behavior,
yeah,
or being
now
forced to change their behavior.
they may have never told the organization that they're trans. I mean,
Exactly.
you know, we talk about sensitive personal data if you're into your GDPR category. So that's a tricky one, isn't it? You know, you
It
just
is.
think it can't be the purpose of the legislation or the purpose of the guidance to kind of deal with things in that way. But moving on, you've then got the potential for a clash of protected characteristics as well, right? And, you know, if we cast our minds back to that case in Northern Ireland, I think it was the Baker's case, in respect of, was it like the gay cake case,
Gay
wasn't
cake, yeah. So it
it?
was
Gay cake.
a celebration cake for a gay marriage, wasn't it?
Right, yeah.
That's it, where the bakers refused to bake it because they didn't, their Christian beliefs didn't support the purpose for which the cake was ordered.
Yeah. Now, You can see scope for clashes of protected characteristics, and it's well established case law now that people who hold gender critical beliefs are capable of protection, again within the meaning of the Equality Act. But if you've got
That's
employers,
your religion or belief point, isn't it? That's the protected characteristic.
So if you've got employers who are allowing trans women to use women's toilets, women can raise complaints for discrimination and harassment. But if you bar trans women from using women's toilets, then what does that mean in terms of complaints for discrimination and harassment on the grounds of gender reassignment? You've got this separate protected characteristic there, which is also capable of protection under the Equality Act.
I mean, we kind of had a bit of a chat around that this morning. So, just to get into the nub of sort of the discrimination laws, indirect discrimination, if you remember, is where you apply a provision, criteria, or practice which adversely impacts a minority group. So here, the PCP might be you are not permitted to use a certain toilet facility, for example. Now, would they be able to bring a claim for indirect discrimination? Well, it probably wouldn't be successful, of course, because now we have the law saying that that's what, that's the position. So there's your justification of your PCP. But what about harassment? What about them saying that the approach by the employer would create a hostile environment, which is offensive to them? What about potential for direct discrimination? But I mean, coming back to the harassment point, this is again this bit where engagement with your workforce is so important. The sensitivity with which you do that is so important. And if you've got people that are trans in your organization, or or just generally there are people that are going to have concerns about it, it's handling this and explaining the law and how it's going to be implemented with as much sensitivity as you can, taking on board some of their thoughts as to how this might be addressed. And in that sense, the hostile environment point, that is one of the foundation stones of harassment claims, is hopefully to be avoided. I mean, you can't always avoid it, but it is an incredibly sensitive subject for discussion. So,
I think should we pause at that point? Just look at some of the comments and questions. There's a lot of interesting stuff in there. So in terms of the questions, sorry, I don't think you addressed this, Adrian, yet. Somebody has asked, we rent a small head office, two toilets, one male, one female. So which toilet would we expect a trans employee to use if they don't feel comfortable using biological sex? Well, I mean, I think this judgment means that, and looking at the guidance, they're not permitted to use the gender that they identify, the sex that they identify with, basically. So if you've got a trans male employee, so was biologically female or is biologically female, but lives as a male, even if they've got a gender recognition certificate, they're not supposed to use the male toilet.
but
Now,
equally, there's meant to be facilities provided. And
exactly, and
that question
that's the
is,
answer,
there's only
but
one of each.
there's only one of each. So what do you do? So do you have the ability to reconfigure those two toilets into two generally accessible
But you
toilets?
can't, though, can you? Because you're under a duty to provide single sex facilities in a workplace. So this goes back to that. You said you rent the building. It's a question to push back onto the landlord in terms of, well, what are they going to do about it to meet the law? But this is exactly the problem, that the practical application of this judgment is incredibly difficult. If you are in a building which simply doesn't have scope to act to meet it, where do you sit? What do you do about it? It's really difficult.
Somebody else has said, I've heard a trans judge is planning to take this matter to the European Court. That'll be the European Court of Human Rights. Do you have any information on this and any view on the likelihood of the judgment being overturned? The information I have, probably what you may have read, which is there is a judge, I think it's Victoria Hill, I want to say, might have got
Yes,
that wrong,
that's right.
who is a prominent trans judge and has said that she will be mounting a legal challenge on the basis of European Convention rights
Yes.
being violated, essentially,
Yeah.
each of them. So all I know is that that's what she is saying she is going to do. Don't know about the status of that. I do know that those processes tend to be very long. I was thinking about this morning, could be 2, 3, 4 years down the line. It's quite a slow process. Likelihood of the judgment being overturned, I don't know. I don't
Well, I think
know.
this is the whole issue, isn't it, with a lot of human rights case, because it's interesting that the challenge is going to be mounted on the basis that it's her human rights, and I think she's indicated that there are going to be others that are joining it. It's a breach of the human rights, so you could end up in a situation where the European courts might find that it breaches her human rights, and then it's a question of then where does that leave us in relation to our domestic legislation? So this is why I said at the start, I don't think this is the end of this issue because of exactly that situation.
Exactly. Requirement for providing single-sex spaces in workplaces, why does it not apply for disabled spaces? I think there probably is a requirement in terms of accessibility.
No, I think it means you don't have disabled female and disabled male
Oh, I see.
toilets, which is absolutely right. I think
I
this is
don't
back
know.
to health and safety law again, which is just that places are required to have accessible facilities. But you're absolutely right. There's no differentiation between the sexes.
Stephen's comment here, disabled toilets have already been misused already due to religious beliefs, medical issues, personal use, concern with turning them into unisex or trans access will make it more difficult. The concern a lot of raised is how will the facilities be policed as well? I mean, on that point, somebody else has said, how do you enforce it when a trans woman uses a female designated space? No one's going to monitor. But if there's a complaint, do you ask for a birth certificate? And how do you, someone else has asked, how do you police it? I mean, you're dealing with sensitive personal data, and I don't think there's a general obligation on an individual to disclose, information around that. So there is a practical thing. I mean, I expect that some trans employees, if they're not out in the workplace, will just carry on, doing what they've been doing, perhaps.
Yeah, and I think this is again a practical point. I mean, it's not every workspace that has potential issues like this. It may be that in your organization you live harmoniously side by side, and it's just not going to be something that is complained about. But like a lot of these things, it's trying to get ahead of the curve, isn't it? Because the law is now in place, and if somebody does complain and you haven't done anything about it, then you're kind of stuck. But this is the exact problem of why I think it's muddled, it's not clear, and these are the practical issues. So yes, do you discipline somebody who's breached the law if that's what you've set up? How do you investigate a grievance if somebody makes a complaint without trying to delve into somebody's personal data? These are exactly the type of issues that are just going to flow from this. Whether or not we're going to see that in the code of practice, I just don't know. But I think we're going to see an awful lot of case law that follows off this. It's extraordinarily difficult. So I appreciate that you've all come on this podcast to hear pearls of wisdom from us, and we're probably proving ourselves to be spectacularly failing to answer your questions, for which we are sorry, but it is very much going to be a watch this space and tread the line carefully.
No, I don't feel bad because everybody's scratching their heads and wondering
Yeah.
how it plays out. I think what's useful for us though is actually this information that you're giving in terms of the sort of challenges and questions that you're getting from
Yeah.
your employees as well. And what I would say is when we have the updated code from the Equality and Human Rights Commission, we will for sure be running another session and hopefully we'll have a lot more answers then. So look out for the invite for that one and hopefully we'll have more answers rather than just posing questions. In terms of other areas then, so, and I know some of you are asking this in the chat, employers are being advised to review other policies like pregnancy and maternity policy, because that was another area that was called out. It's recognised that trans men can get pregnant, and therefore, if they suffer discrimination on account of pregnancy, which does not require a comparator, they're still protected under the Equality Act. But then we've got gender pay gap reporting as well, haven't we? For those of you caught by those provisions.
That's right. I mean, that's difficult as well, and that comes back to the GDPR point that we've raised again, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of visibility across your workforce and how you're going to know, how people, well, it's not about how people identify anymore. That's the point. For the purposes of the Equality Act, a male is a biological male and a female is a biological female, right? What I find interesting, by the way, when I was looking at Supreme Court judgment, it was referring back to Parliament and the 1975 Sex Discrimination Act and what was intended by Parliament at the time they drafted that act, which I assume must have been in 1974, let's say. And I thought, well, I wonder what, I mean, I wasn't alive then.
All right.
What the social attitude, how prevalent was this? What was the social dialogue and context around trans rights? And I can't imagine they were anywhere near where they are in 2024, 2025, right?
No, exactly. That was all about the, protection of women and bringing equality between men and women at the time. And society's moved on significantly. So, do we have a situation where the law is not working for today's societal values? I mean, it's a massive question. But can I just, I know we've hit 11:30 already, but I just wanted to just pull in a couple of other things as well in terms of potentially where employers might see the fallout of this. And I think, Peter, you were saying you'd seen a couple of commentaries, interviews, etc. on this, but there is also the potential increased risk of harassment where employees who do hold gender critical beliefs or are, for example, vocal in relation to things like sporting contexts, they might be emboldened to misgender trans people, for example, use of pronouns. You see that an awful lot. And it's really important to remember the point made, which is there is still the protection for people against discrimination and harassment on the grounds of gender reassignment. So that hasn't changed, and that's something that would not be permitted in a workplace and should be dealt with. But and coming back to that sort of the clash between different protected characteristics, whilst we've said that people are entitled to hold their beliefs, remember that the case law has led to that being the finding. However, it's about the manifestation of those beliefs that can potentially create problems in the workplace. So by all means, hold your beliefs, get your protection under religion and belief, but it's in terms of the behavior that employees show in the workplace. So, that is so nuanced and that is such a gray area, but that's definitely something again, which needs to be handled sensitively.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just flicking through some of the comments actually while you were talking there about outing. Interesting. Some people are getting colleagues with gender critical beliefs asking why policies haven't been updated yet. Some people are getting the message that the guidance suggests that people can choose which toilet facilities to use, which I don't think that's the I don't think that is the case. As Adrian said, it's a really difficult area. When you start, it's simple and it's difficult, right? You look at the judgment, and the judgment's binary. It's black and white. It's like, look, this is what it means under the Equality Act. We can give some certainty. Man means this, woman means this, and this is what's meant by sex within it. So off you go. As ever with employment law, the devil's in the practical application of it. And as we're having these conversations and working through the practical implications, it just raises more questions than we've got answers for. So this absolutely isn't the end of the story at all. It's just the beginning of things. We're going to have the European Court of Human Rights challenge, but as I've said, it's going to last for a very long time if that goes through. So we're not going to get any quick answers there. But I think in terms of takeaway points in the meantime, really look at engaging with your workforce. Like Adrienne said, there's always an opportunity in terms of employee engagement and reaching out to those communities. And that can be both sides of the conversation if you notice that, you have two sides with some with gender critical beliefs and those without. So there's an opportunity for engagement. Considering also what are the risks around taking action now or not taking any action, I think you're probably justified in pausing and just waiting for the updated statutory code of practice because that's what's going to be relevant. It's going to be a statutory code. It's not going to be like ACAS, it's not going to be guidance, it's going to be a code of practice that you're expected to adhere to. So, understandably, you need to have the detail of that code of practice. We've been given a time scale on it, we're told it's going to go for ministerial approval sometime in June. So, I think you're justified in probably just reassuring employees at the moment that the matter is in hand and waiting to see what that code of practice actually says, because that's going to give you the information that you need. I think it's
Hopefully.
Hopefully, well, we hope it is. Yeah, absolutely. Just be mindful about people's beliefs and, disrespectful behavior within a workplace environment's never going to be tolerated anyway. Well, if anyone's got any other suggestions about what approaches you're taking within your workforce, then, we welcome hearing about them.
I'm just going to jump in and deal with one comment that's come up in the questions, which is absolutely right. So the code of practice that's coming in at the end of June will be dealing with services. And there is a question mark over whether it's going to deal with employment, but I think there's move afoot to push for that to cover employment and workplaces as well, because otherwise, what the hell do employers do? So, but I think coming back to the point in terms of comms to your workforce, absolutely, it's the communication that matters are in hand, and that you are aware of it, you are doing something about it, and you're waiting for the detail.
No, absolutely.
But and in the meantime, yes, there is going to be a risk that certain people may well raise complaints in the meantime, and don't have the answer about how you deal with that other than as sensitively as possible, trying to find a solution.
Yeah, perfect. Okay. Thanks to all of you that have stuck around and have gone over time very slightly, but really, really appreciate all the views that you've expressed on the chat. Sorry we haven't been able to answer all of your questions. If you've got any really burning questions and you want some insight from us, then you can email us at NPM Legal. A couple of people commented to say that they're joining on behalf of other people today, which is fantastic. If you want to sign up directly for these webinars, just go on our website, NPM Legal. You can sign up direct and then you'll get the invites directly. In the chat, I put a link to Spotify, where we've got all of our episodes, including our last one on redundancy and reorganization pitfalls. So look out for that. Otherwise, we're back in 2 weeks' time, 11 a.m., same time, 2 weeks today. In the meantime, have a fab weekend. Enjoy the sunshine. So thanks, everybody.